much with Professor Dan Flores. His new book is Wild New World, the epic story of animals and people in America. We've established that the philosophy used by the hunters and the profiteers of the 18th to 19th century is still in place. And yet, in the 20th century, there are first small demonstrated efforts to preserve this or that creature, and then large scale. And now in the 21st century, there's a recognition, naturalism, ecology, that what was done in order to build America was wrongheaded, and it can be corrected. However, I want to go to a couple of small successes here that are a joy to celebrate. The ivory-billed woodpecker, Professor, this is such a surprise because I wrote down in my notes, disappeared, last one, 1940s.
Well, the story is it's miraculous, but it's also tragic. We do think now, according to the Fish and Wildlife Service, about a year ago, that the ivory bill is extinct. There are always people in the South, which was the ivory bill's original range, who believe they are seeing ivory bills, and so there are endless stories that in some bayou or swamp somewhere in the Carolinas or in Louisiana, there are still some around. But this was, of course, America's contribution to our candidate for the largest, most charismatic woodpecker in the world. It was one of our iconic animals from the colonial period into the 20th century. But it, along with a whole host of other birds, became threatened and acknowledged as threatened by the 1930s. For example, the Northeast, New England in particular, had a particular kind of bird called the heath hen, which was an eastern prairie chicken, which became extinct as people actually stood and watched it happen in the late 1920s. Into about 1931, when the last bird disappeared. During that same period, trumpeter swans, our largest water bird in America, were down to fewer than 100 birds. Whooping cranes were down to only 16 left. Even bald eagles were being threatened because they were regarded by the livestock industry as a possible threat to raising sheep and goats. And the ivory bill at the same time was actually pronounced extinct by ornithologists in 1931, only to have a discovery made a few years later of seven pairs of ivory bills living in a sort of overlooked piece of old growth forest along the Mississippi River in Louisiana. And so Columbia University Cornell sends out a young naturalist, James Tanner was his name, to study these last few ivory bills. And he wrote a marvelous book of ivory bill natural history. We even ended up with actual photographs of ivory bills, one of which I reproduce in a book. It's a very rare thing to have a photograph of an ivory bill. But the tragedy of that story was that a sewing machine company, the Singer Sewing Machine Company, owned that tract of land and turned over the logging rights to that tract to a logging company from Chicago. So by the early 1940s, that old tract, old growth tract with those last few ivory bills remaining was logged. And we have struggled to find ivory bills ever since until, as I said at the outset of this, a year ago now, in 2021, the Fish and Wildlife Service actually proclaimed that the ivory bill was extinct in the United States.
Are we still searching? Because you note the incident in 2005 in Montana. Is it still possible that we just have not located them, or is it gone?
Yes, and that incident actually happened in Arkansas. It was in a national wildlife refuge. I was living in Montana at the time, and as someone who had grown up in Louisiana and had looked for ivory bills most of my young life, I was tremendously excited by what we thought was the discovery of an ivory bill population in Arkansas. But after superhuman efforts and several years of investigation by Cornell, the ornithology lab there, and by the Fish and Wildlife Service, everyone had to conclude that it didn't appear as if there were ivory bills there after all.
Rachel Carson, we mentioned quickly, but importantly, Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, enormously persuasive. Is that the foundation for the Endangered Species Act and for the work that was done in the 1970s?
Well, I would say that Rachel Carson's book is most important in convincing the American public to step back and look at what we had done to American nature, and particularly, of course, to be wary of poisoning of wildlife that, in contrast to the animals we had saved to hunt, this whole other category of animals out there, including most of our big predators, were creatures that we were still trying to eradicate with seemingly, even into the 1960s, little sense of the role that they had played anciently in American ecology. And so Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, I think, is central to convincing this generation, of which I was a member, I was in college at the time, that everyone was discussing Silent Spring, to look with a more careful eye at what was happening in the world. I would say that the Endangered Species Act itself probably dates back to that 1930s period I was mentioning a few minutes ago, where so many of these grand birds are disappearing, with the passage of what's called the Bald Eagle Protection Act in 1940. It's the first time we sort of recognized that we should do something to try to stop the impending extinction, in this case, of our national symbol. So when people began talking about saving endangered species in the 1960s and 1970s, that's where they started, with that Bald Eagle Protection Act. And then, of course, in 1973, we passed what I argue in Wild New World is one of the great pieces of legislation that America has ever produced, the Endangered Species Act of 1973.
The coyote and the wolf, we've focused on how they've been abused, both those creatures. And here we are now, the coyote and the wolf. Are there now firm, established scientific studies recognize that they're not a threat to the herd, that they are the apex predator, an important part of an ecosystem?
Well, John, there are all sorts of wonderful studies going back to the Murray brothers' work, especially Adolph Murray's The Wolves of Mount McKinley in the 1940s. And so we've got wonderful work that demonstrates all this and the role that these predators play in organizing ecologies. But I would say that even in the wake of the Endangered Species Act, which has helped us recover wolf populations, what we've confronted in America is this lingering idea of human exceptionalism, so that wolf recovery, the survival of coyotes, continues to be a political football. It continues to be something that only some Americans embrace. And there's another population of Americans out there that still does not want us to have wolves or coyotes in America. And so I would say the battle actually goes on into our own time.
Despite the fact that we can demonstrate that wolves are smart and think and pass on customs to their offspring, we can demonstrate all of that. You do it often. And that is still used as a way of wiping the wolf out still?
Unfortunately, still, yes. And this all goes back to, of course, what's called delisting animals under the Endangered Species Act. And what's happened in recent years is that returning the management of the gray wolf, particularly in places like Wisconsin and Montana and Idaho, back to the state has resulted in a kind of a political battle over trying to reduce wolves to the bare minimum that won't get the Endangered Species Act in place again.
The book is Wild New World, the epic story of animals and people in America. Dan Flores is the author. I'm John Bash.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor,